from The Clicking of Cuthbert by P.G. Woodhouse. On the young man's face as he sat sipping ginger ale in the clubhouse smoking room, there was a look of disillusionment.
"Never again," he said.
The oldest member glanced up from his paper. "You're proposing to give up golf once more?" he queried.
"Not golf, betting on golf,"
the young man frowned.
"I've just been let down badly. Wouldn't you have thought I had a good thing, laying 7-1 on McTavish against Robinson?"
"Undoubtedly," said the sage. "The odds, indeed generous as they are, scarcely indicate the former superiority. Do you mean to tell me that the thing came unstitched?"
"Robinson won at a walk after being 3 down at the turn."
"Strange. What happened?"
"Why, they looked in at the bar to have a refresher before starting for the 10th, said the young man, his voice quivering. "And McTavish suddenly discovered that there was a hole in his trousers pocket and 6 pence had dropped out. He worried so frightfully about it that on the 2nd 9 he couldn't do a thing right, went completely off his game and didn't win a hole."
The sage shook his head gravely. "If this is really going to be a lesson to you, my boy, never bet on the result of a golf match. It will be a blessing in disguise. There is no such thing as certainty in golf. I wonder if I ever told you a rather curious episode in the career of Vincent Jopp."
"The Vincent Jopp? The American multimillionaire?"
"The same. You never knew he once came within an ace of winning the American Amateur Championship, did you?"
"I never heard of him playing golf."
"He played for 1 season. After that, he gave it up and has not touched a club since. Ring the bell and get me a small lime juice, and I will tell you all." "It was long before your time," said the oldest member, "that the events which I am about to relate took place. I had just come down from Cambridge and was feeling particularly pleased with myself because I had secured the job of private and confidential secretary to Vincent Jopp, then a man in his early 30s, busy laying the foundations of his present remarkable fortune. He engaged me and took me with him to Chicago. Jopp was, I think, the most extraordinary personality I have encountered in a long and many-sided life. He was admirably equipped for success in finance, having the steely eye and square jaw without which it is hopeless for a man to enter that line of business. He possessed also an overwhelming confidence in himself and the ability to switch a cigar from one corner of his mouth to the other without wiggling his ears, which, as you know, is the stamp of a true monarch of the money market. He was the nearest approach to the financier on the films, the fellow who makes his jaw muscles jump when he is telephoning, that I have ever seen. Like all successful men, he was a man of method. He kept a pad on his desk on which he would scribble down his appointments, and it was my duty, on entering the office each morning, to take this pad and type its contents neatly in a loose-leafed ledger. Usually, of course, these entries referred to business appointments and deals which he was contemplating. But one day I was interested to note, against the date May 3rd, the entry "Proposed to Amelia." I was interested, as I say, but not surprised. Though a man of steel and iron, there was nothing of the celebrate about Vincent Jopp. He was one of those men who marry early and often. On 3 separate occasions before I joined his service, he had jumped off the dock to scramble back to shore again later by means of the divorce court lifebelt. Scattered here and there about the country, there were 3 ex-Mrs. Jopps drawing their monthly envelope, and now it seemed he complicated the addition of a 4th to the platoon. I was not surprised, I say, at this resolve of his. What did seem a little remarkable to me was the thorough way in which he had thought the thing out. This iron-willed man recked nothing of possible obstacles. Under the date of June 1st was the entry, "Marry Amelia," while in March of the following year he had arranged to have his firstborn christened Thomas Reginald. Later on, the short coating of Thomas Reginald was arranged for, and there was a note about sending him to school. Many hard things have been said about Vincent Jopp, but nobody has ever accused him of not being a man who looked ahead. On the morning of May 4th, Jopp came into the office looking, I fancied, a little thoughtful. He sat for some moments staring before him, with his brow a trifle furrowed. Then he seemed to come to himself. He rapped his desk.
"Hi, you!"
he said. It was thus he habitually addressed me. "Mr. Jopp," I replied.
"What's golf?"
I had, at that time, just succeeded in getting my handicap down into single figures, and I welcomed the opportunity of dilating on the noblest of pastimes. But I had barely begun my eulogy when he stopped me.
"It's a game, isn't it?"
"I suppose you could call it that," I said, "but it is an offhand way of describing the holiest..."
"How do you play it?"
"Pretty well," I said. At the beginning of the season, I didn't seem able to keep them straight at all, but lately I've been doing fine, getting better every day. Whether it was I was moving my head or gripping too tightly with the right hand...
Keep the reminiscences for your children during long winter evenings, he interrupted abruptly, as was his habit. What I want to know is what a fellow does when he plays golf. Tell me in as few words as you can just what it's all about.
You hit a ball with a stick till it falls into a hole.
Easy, he snapped. Take dictation.
I produced my pad.
May the 5th. Take up golf. What's an amateur championship?
It's the annual competition to decide which is the best player among amateurs. There is also a professional championship and an open event.
Oh, there are golf professionals, are there? What do they do?
They teach golf.
Which is the best of them?
Sandy McHoots won both British and American Open events last year.
Wire him to come here at once.
But McHoots is at Inverlochty in Scotland.
Never mind, get him. Tell him to name his own terms. When is the amateur championship?
I think it's on September the 12th this year.
All right, take dictation. September 12th, win amateur championship.
I stared at him in amazement, but he was not looking at me.
Got that, he said. September 3rd. Oh, I was forgetting. At September 12th, corner wheat. September 13th, Mary Amelia.
Mary Amelia, I echoed, moistening my pencil.
Where do you play this, what's its name, golf?
There are clubs all over the country. I belong to the Wissahicky Glen.
Is that a good place?
Very good.
Arrange today for my becoming a member.
Sandy McHoots arrived in due course and was shown into the private office.
Mr. McHoots,
said Vincent Jopp.
Humph,
said the Open champion.
I've sent for you, Mr. McHoots, because I hear that you are the greatest living exponent of this game, golf.
Aye, said the champion cordially,
I am that. I wish you to teach me the game. I am already somewhat behind schedule owing to the delay incident upon your long journey, so let us start at once. Name a few of the most important points in connection with the game. My secretary will make notes of them, and I will memorize them. In this way, we shall save time. Now, what is the most important thing to remember when playing golf?
Keep your head still.
A simple task?
Not so simple as it seems.
Nonsense, said Vincent Jopp curtly. If I decide to keep my head still, I shall keep it still. What next?
Keep your eye on the bar.
It shall be attended to. And the next?
Do not press.
I won't. And to resume.
Mr. McHoots ran through a dozen of the basic rules, and I took them down in shorthand. Vincent Jopp studied the list.
Very good. Easier than I had supposed. On the first tee at Wissahicky Glen at 11 sharp tomorrow, Mr. McHoots... Hi, you!
Sir, I said.
Go out and buy me a set of clubs, a cloth cap, a pair of spiked shoes, and a ball.
One ball?
Certainly. What need is there more?
It sometimes happens, I explained, that a player who is learning the game fails to hit his ball straight, and then he often loses it in the rough side of the fairway.
Absurd, said Vincent Jopp. If I set out to drive my ball straight, I shall drive it straight. Good morning, Mr. McHoots. You'll excuse me now. I am busy concerning woven textiles.
Golf is, in its essence, a simple game. You laugh in a sharp, bitter, barking manner when I say this, but nevertheless it is true, where the average man goes wrong in making the game difficult for himself. Observe the non-player, the man who walks around with you for the sake of fresh air. He will hole out a single carefree flick of his umbrella, the 20-foot putt over which you would ponder and hesitate for a full minute before sending it right off the line. Put a driver in his hands and he takes the ball into the next country without a thought. It is only when he takes to the game in earnest that he becomes self-conscious and anxious, and tops his shots even as you and I. A man who could retain through his golfing career the almost scornful confidence of a non-player would be unbeatable. Fortunately, such an attitude of mind is beyond the scope of human nature. It was not, however, beyond the scope of Vincent Jopp, the Superman. Vincent Jopp was, I am inclined to think, the only golfer who ever approached the game in a spirit of pure reason. I have read of men who, never having swum in their lives, studied a textbook on their way down to the swimming bath, mastered its contents, and dived in and won the big race. In just such a spirit did Vincent Jopp start to play golf. He committed McHoots' hints to memory and then went out on the links and put them into practice. He came to the tee with a clear picture in his mind of what he had to do, and he did it. He was not intimidated, like the average novice, by the thought that if he pulled in his hands he would slice, or if he gripped too tightly with the right he would pull. Pulling in his hands was an error, so he did not pull in his hands. Gripping too tightly was a defect, so he did not grip too tightly. With that weird concentration which had served him so well in business, he did precisely what he had set out to do. No less and no more. Golf with Vincent Jopp was an exact science. The annals of the game are studded with the names of those who have made rapid progress in their first season. Colonel Quill, we read in our Varden, took up golf at the age of 56, and by devising an ingenious machine consisting of a fishing line and a sawed-down bedpost, was enabled to keep his head so still that he became a scratch player before the end of the year. But no one, I imagine, except Vincent Jopp, has ever achieved scratch on his first morning out on the links. The main difference, we are told, between the amateur and the professional golfer is the fact that the latter is always aiming at the pin, while the former has in his mind a vague picture of getting somewhat reasonably near it. Vincent Jopp invariably went for the pin. He tried to hole out from anywhere inside 220 yards. The only occasion on which I ever heard him express any chagrin or disappointment was during the afternoon round on his first day out, when from the tee on the 280-yard seventh he laid his ball within 6 inches of the hole. "A marvelous shot!" I cried, genuinely stirred.
"Too much to the right," said Vincent Jopp, frowning.
He went on from triumph to triumph. He won the monthly medal in May, June, July, August, and September. Toward the end of May, he was heard to complain that the Wissahicky Glen was not a sporting course. Greens Committee sat up night after night trying to adjust his handicap so as to give the other members an outside chance against him. The golf experts of the daily papers wrote columns about his play, and it was pretty generally considered throughout the country that it would be a pure formality for anyone else to enter against him in the amateur championship, an opinion which was borne out when he got through the final without losing a hole. A safe man to have betted on, you would have said, but mark the sequel. The American Amateur Championship was held that year in Detroit. I had accompanied my employer there, for, though engaged on this nerve-wearing contest, he refused to allow his business to be interfered with. As he had indicated on his schedule, he was busy at the time cornering wheat, and it was my task to combine the duties of caddy and secretary. Each day I accompanied him round the links with my notebook and his bag of clubs, and the progress of his various matches was somewhat complicated by the arrival of a stream of telegraph boys bearing important messages. He would read these between strokes and dictate replies to me, never, however, taking more than 5 minutes allowed by the rules for an interval between strokes. I am inclined to think that it was this that put the finishing touch on his opponent's discomfiture. It is not soothing for a nervous man to have the game hung up on the green while his adversary dictates to his caddy a letter beginning, "Yours of the 11th instantly received and contents noted," in reply would state. This sort of thing puts a man off his game. I was resting in the lobby of our hotel after a strenuous day's work when I found that I was being paged. I answered the summons and was informed that a lady wished to see me. Her card bore the name Miss Amelia Merridew. Amelia! That name seemed familiar. I remembered. Amelia was the name of the girl Vincent Jopp intended to marry, the fourth of the long line of Mrs. Jopps. I hurried to present myself and found a tall, slim girl who was plainly laboring under a considerable agitation. "Miss Merridew," I said. "Yes," she murmured, "my name may be strange to you." "Am I right," I queried, "in supposing that you are the lady to whom Mr. Jopp—" "I am, I am," she replied, "and oh, what shall I do?" "Kindly give me the particulars," I said, taking out a pad from force of habit. She hesitated a moment, as if afraid to speak. "You are caddying for Mr. Jopp in the final tomorrow?" she said at last. "I am." "Then would it be giving you too much trouble if I asked you to shout boo at him while he was making his stroke, if he looks like winning?" I was perplexed. "I don't understand." "I see that I must tell you all. I'm sure you'll treat what I say as absolutely confidential."
"Certainly."
"I'm provisionally engaged to Mr. Jopp."
"Provisionally?"
She gulped. "Let me tell you my story. Mr. Jopp asked me to marry him, and I would rather do anything on earth than marry him. But how could I say no with those awful eyes boring me through? I knew that if I said no, he would argue me out of it in 2 minutes. I had an idea. I gathered that he had never played golf, so I told him that I would marry him if he won the amateur championship this year. And now I find that he has been a golfer all along, and, what is more, a plus man. It isn't fair!"
"He was not a golfer when you made that condition," I said. "He took up the game on the following day."
"Impossible! How could he have become as good as he is in this short time?"
"Because he is Vincent Jopp. In his lexicon there is no such word as impossible." She shuddered.
What a man! But I can't marry him," she cried. "I want to marry somebody else. Oh, won't you help me? Do shout boo at him when he is starting his downswing." I shook my head. It would take more than a single boo to put Vincent Jopp off his stroke. "But won't you try it?" "I cannot. My duty is to my employer."
"Oh, do."
"No, no. Duty is duty and paramount with me. Besides, I've made a bet on him to win." The stricken girl uttered a faint moan and tottered away.
I was in our suite shortly after dinner that night, going over some of the notes I had made that day when the telephone rang. Jopp was out at the time, taking a short stroll with his after-dinner cigar. I unhooked the receiver, and a female voice spoke.
"Is that Mr. Jopp?"
"Mr. Jopp's secretary speaking. Mr. Jopp is up."
"Oh, it's nothing important. Will you say that Mrs. Luella Mainprice Jopp called up to wish him luck? I shall be on the course tomorrow to see him win the final."
I returned to my notes. Soon afterwards, the telephone rang again.
"Vincent, dear?"
"Mr. Jopp's secretary speaking."
"Oh, will you say that Mrs. Jane Jukes Jopp called up to wish him luck? I shall be there tomorrow to see him play."
I resumed my work. I had hardly started when the telephone rang for the third time.
"Mr. Jopp?"
"Mr. Jopp's secretary speaking."
"This is Mrs. Agnes Parsons Jopp. I just called up to wish him luck. I shall be looking on tomorrow."
I shifted my work nearer to the telephone table so as to be ready for the next call. I had heard that Vincent Jopp had only been married three times, but you never knew. Presently, Jopp came in.
"Anybody call up?"
he asked. "Nobody on business. An assortment of your wives were on the wire wishing you luck. They asked me to say that they will be on the course tomorrow." For a moment, it seemed that the man's iron repose was shaken.
"Luella?"
he asked. She was the first.
"Jane?"
"And Jane."
"And Agnes?"
"Agnes," I said, "is right."
"Hmph,"
said Vincent Jopp. And for the first time since I had known him, I thought he was ill at ease.
The day of the final dawned bright and clear. At least I was not awake at the time to see, but I supposed it did. For at 9 o'clock, when I came down to breakfast, the sun was shining brightly. The first 18 holes were to be played before lunch, starting at 11. Until 20 minutes before the hour, Vincent Jopp kept me busy taking dictation, partly on matters connected with his wheat deal and partly on a signed article dealing with the final entitled, "How I Won." At 11 sharp, we were out on the first tee. Jopp's opponent was a nice-looking man, but obviously nervous. He giggled in a distraught sort of way as he shook hands with my employer.
"Well, may the best man win," he said.
"I have arranged to do so,"
replied Jopp curtly, and started to address his ball. There was a large crowd at the tee, and as Jopp started his downswing, from somewhere on the outskirts of this crowd there came a sudden musical boo! It rang out in the clear morning air like a bugle. I had been right in my estimate of Vincent Jopp. His forceful stroke never wavered. The head of his club struck the ball, dispatching it a good 200 yards down the middle of the fairway. As we left the tee, I saw Amelia Meridew being led away with bowed head by two members of the Greens Committee. Poor girl. My heart bled for her. And yet, after all, fate had been kind in removing her from the scene, even in custody, for she could hardly have borne to watch the proceedings. Vincent Jopp made rings around his antagonist. Hole after hole, he won in his remorseless, machine-like way, until, when lunchtime came at the end of the 18th, he was 10 up. All the other holds had been halved. It was after lunch, as we made our way to the first tee, that the advance guard of the Mrs. Jopps appeared in the person of Luella Mainprice Jopp, a kittenish little woman with blonde hair and a Pekingese dog. I remember reading in the papers that she had divorced my employer for persistent and aggravated mental cruelty, calling witnesses to bear out her statement that he had said he did not like her in pink, and that on two separate occasions he had insisted on her dog eating the leg of a chicken instead of the breast. But time, the great healer, seemed to have removed all bitterness, and she greeted him affectionately.
"Wasson's going to win the great big championship against the rough strong man," she said.
"Such," said Vincent Jopp, "is my intention. It was kind of you, Luella, to trouble to come and watch me. I wonder if you know Miss Agnes Parsons Jopp,"
he said courteously, indicating a kind-looking, motherly woman who had just come up.
"How are you, Agnes?"
"If you had asked me that question this morning, Vincent," replied Mrs. Agnes Parsons Jopp, "I would have been obliged to say that I felt far from well. I had an odd, throbbing feeling in the left elbow, and I'm sure my temperature was up above normal. But this afternoon I am feeling a little better. How are you, Vincent?"
Although she had, as I recalled from the reports of the case, been compelled some years earlier to request the court to sever her marital relationships with Vincent Jopp on the ground of calculated and inhuman brutality, in that he had callously refused, in spite of her pleadings, to take old Dr. Bennett's tonic swamp juice 3 times a day, her voice as she spoke was kind and even anxious. Badly as this man had treated her, and I remember hearing that several of the jury had been unable to restrain their tears when she was in the witness box giving her evidence, there still seemed to linger some remnants of the old affection.
"I am quite well, thank you, Agnes," said Vincent Jopp.
"Are you wearing your liver pad?" A frown flitted across my employer's strong face.
"I am not wearing my liver pad," he replied brusquely.
"Oh, Vincent, how rash of you!"
He was about to speak when a sudden exclamation from his rear checked him. A genial-looking woman in a sports coat was standing there eyeing him in a sort of humorous horror.
"Well, Jane," he said.
I gathered that this was Mrs. Jane Jukes Jopp, the wife who had divorced him for systematic and ingrowing fiendishness on the ground that he had repeatedly outraged her feelings by wearing a white waistcoat with a dinner jacket. She continued to look at him dumbly, and then uttered a sort of strangled, hysterical laugh.
"Those legs!" she cried. "Those legs!"
Vincent Jopp flushed darkly. Even the strongest and most silent of us have our weaknesses, and my employer's was the rooted idea that he looked well in his knickerbockers. It was not my place to try to dissuade him, but there was no doubt that they did not suit him. Nature, in bestowing upon him a massive head and jutting chin, had forgotten to finish him off at the other end. Vincent Jopp's legs were skinny.
"You poor dear man,"
went on Mrs. Jane Jukes Jopp.
"What practical joker ever lured you into appearing in public in knickerbockers?"
"I don't object to knickerbockers," said Mrs. Agnes Parsons Jopp, "but when he foolishly comes out in quite a strong east wind without his liver pad..."
"Little Tinky Ting don't need a liver pad, he don't," said Mrs. Luella Mainprice Jopp, addressing the animal in her arms, "because he was his mother's pet, he was."
I was standing quite near to Vincent Jopp, and at this moment I saw a bead of perspiration spring out on his forehead, and into his steely eyes there came a positively hunted look. I could understand and sympathize. Napoleon himself would have wilted if he'd found himself in the midst of a trio of females, one talking baby talk, another fussing about his health, and the third making derogatory observations on his lower limbs. Vincent Jopp was becoming unstrung.
"May as well be starting, shall we?"
It was Jopp's opponent who spoke. There was a strange, set look on his face, the look of a man whose back is against the wall. 10 down on the morning's round, and he had drawn his reserves of courage and was determined to meet the inevitable bravely. Vincent Jopp nodded absently, then turned to me.
"Keep those women away from me," he whispered tersely. "They'll put me off my stroke."
"Put you off your stroke?" I exclaimed incredulously.
"Yes, me. How the deuce can I concentrate with these people battling about liver pads and knickerbockers all around me? Keep them away."
He started to address his ball, and there was a weak uncertainty in the way he did it that prepared me for what was to come. His club rose, wavered, fell, and the ball, badly toppled, trickled 2 feet and sank into a cuppy lie.
"Is that good or bad?" inquired Miss Luella Mainprice Jopp.
A sort of desperate hope gleamed in the eye of the other competitor in the final. He swung with renewed vigor. His ball sang through the air and lay within a chip's shot distance of the green.
"At the very least," said Mrs. Agnes Parsons Jopp, "I hope, Vincent, that you are wearing flannel next to your skin."
I heard Jopp give a stifled groan as he took his spoon from the bag. He made a gallant effort to retrieve the lost ground, but the ball struck a stone and bounded away into the long grass to the side of the green. His opponent won the hole. We moved on to the second tee.
"Now that, young man,"
said Mrs. Jane Jukes Jopp, indicating her late husband's blushing antagonist,
"is quite right to wear knickerbockers. He can carry them off, but a glance in the mirror must have shown you..."
"I'm sure you're feverish, Vincent,"
said Mrs. Agnes Parsons Jopp solicitously.
"You are quite flushed. There's a wild gleam in your eyes."
"Mother's pet's got little buttons of eyes that don't never have no wild gleam in them, because he's Mother's own darling, he is,"
said Mrs. Luella Mainprice Jopp. A hollow groan escaped Vincent Jopp's ashen lips. I need not recount the play hole by hole, I think. There are some subjects that are too painful. It was pitiful to watch Vincent Jopp in his downfall. By the end of the first nine, his lead had been reduced to one, and his antagonist, rendered a new man by success, was playing magnificent golf. On the next hole, he drew level. Then, with superhuman effort, Jopp contrived to have the 11th, 12th, and 13th. It seemed as though his iron will might still assert itself, but on the 14th, the end came. He had driven a superb ball, outdistancing his opponent by a full 50 yards. The latter played a good second to within a few feet of the green, and then as Vincent Jopp was shaping for his stroke, Luella Mainprice gave tongue.
"Vincent!
Wow!
Wasn't that other man, bad man, not playing fair? When your back was turned just now, he gave his ball a great eye. I was watching him."
At any rate, said Mrs. Agnes Parsons Jopp, I do hope when the game is over, Vincent, you will remember to cool slowly.
Flusho! Replied Mrs. Jane Jukes Jopp triumphantly. I've been trying to remember the name all afternoon. I saw about it in one of the papers. The advertisements speak most highly of it. You take it before breakfast, and again before retiring, and they guarantee it to produce firm, healthy flesh that will most sparsely cover the limbs in the next no time. Now will you remember to get the bottle tonight? It comes in two sizes, the 5-shilling, or large size, and the smaller at 1/2 crown.
Vincent Jopp uttered a quavering moan, and his hand, as he took the mashie from his bag, was trembling like an aspen. 10 minutes later, he was on his way back to the clubhouse, a beaten man.
And so, concluded the oldest member, you see that in golf there is no such thing as a soft snap. You can never be certain of the finest player. Anything may happen to the greatest expert at any stage of the game. In a recent competition, George Duncan took 11 shots over a hole, which 18 handicap men generally do in 5. No. Back horses or go down to the Throgmorton Street and try to take it away from the Rothschilds, and I will applaud you as a shrewd and cautious financier. But to bet at golf is pure gambling. End of chapter.